And then at the close of the comment period, the task force reviewed the comments received, made some revisions to the report, and here we are today. Clearly, this is a very serious issue. It's got far-reaching implications for Portland as well as for the globe as a whole. Working with the task force, for me personally, has helped me think about this a lot more broadly, I think especially in terms of how this can play out in social impacts. It's a lot more than just a technical energy issue. I think in part because of the breadth of this issue and also the scale and scope of the impacts, staffing it has required a real team effort. And we really had great staff help from a number of bureaus. Bureau of Planning with Steve Dotterer, Office of Transportation, Lavinia Gordon and Peter Hurley, Office of Emergency Management, Patty Reuter, as well as other staff from the Office of Sustainable Development, Matt Emlin, Kyle Diesner, Andrea Jacob. And then, as Commissioner Saltzman noted, we were extremely fortunate to have great assistance from the Oregon Department of Energy. Sean Kaufman provided superb technical assistance and really provided a lot of the research that went into this. And then we also had help from a former Oregon Department of Energy staff person, Charlie Stevens, who's also a wealth of knowledge. So it really was a great staff effort to bring all these pieces together. And at the same time, clearly, the real force behind this work was the task force. Hundreds of hours in meetings alone, thousands of emails that got circulated, and lots of hours away from busy work schedules and families. And all of that really has gone to help the city think through how this issue might play out and how what we can do to prepare. As you noted, many of them are here today, and hopefully you'll have a chance to hear from a few of them. I've really been grateful for their expertise and dedication and the thoughtfulness that they brought to this work. I think Bill Scott is a superb example of that and has really provided outstanding leadership to the task force. So it's a pleasure then to turn this over to Bill Scott, who's been the chair of the task force.
Thank you, Michael. And I especially want to thank Michael, who is the one that orchestrated all of the other people he named and really provided the task force, I think, with a tremendous depth and breadth of assistance, and staff was very easy to work with and very responsive. I'm going to try to just pretty briefly go through the thinking that's reflected in the report and the actions we're urging you to take, and feel free to ask questions as we go along. But I may refer them to other members of the task force, and I also hope that you'll give them a chance to make any additional comments they have when I'm finished. First of all, I think the task force tried to educate ourselves as much as we could about the subject of peak oil. I think we certainly became convinced that there's no question that the price of oil and natural gas is going to go up, and the availability of oil and natural gas is going to go down, and that's our future. There are lots of questions about when and, you know, exactly what the slope is and those kind of things. But I think that the only prudent thing for all of us to do is to prepare for a different world than the one we lived in for the last 100 years in terms of the some of the main inputs to our economy and our lives. The more expensive, more scarce oil and natural gas essentially means that we're going to spend more of our household and business budgets on those commodities, have less to spend on other things, but the other things will also be more expensive because they have inputs of oil and natural gas. So there's obviously a lot of change ahead. Every business will have to adapt to this kind of thing, and some of them will have to change their business models enormously. Others, it's a fairly minor adaptation. And for many businesses, I think it's kind of unpredictable how much their markets might shrink or change as a result. A lot of change for business means inevitably a lot of unemployment, as some businesses make it, some don't. New businesses begin that may replace that employment, but for the individual family that has to go through a spell of unemployment, it can be a permanent tragedy. At the same time, there are opportunities for businesses and individuals that learn to navigate the transition and figure out business models that will work in the post in the peak oil period, in the period of oil and gas decline. And I think Portland in lots of ways has advantages there. The one thing in the impact area that we particularly want to note is the special vulnerability of the our least affluent citizens and the populations that are marginalized or vulnerable are the ones that are probably going to be first to lose their jobs. They may be the ones that are spending the highest proportion of their income on their transportation or on their heating their homes. So I think that was maybe the thing that not all of us were prepared for is the extent to which we need to really be focused on not just the overall competitiveness and livability of our city, but also on specifically the challenges for our citizens who are going to be least able to handle it. So those are the kind of issues that every community is going to have. Portland, in general, is ahead of most U.S. cities. There's some graphs in our presentation that show that through aggressive policy by this city council and by many private citizens and the state of Oregon, we've done a bunch of things that have moved us further along than other cities have been in terms of adapting to the kind of a future that we see, and there are lots, maybe more businesses in Portland than other places that are leading the way in showing the world how to adapt, consultants on energy conservation, people in developing alternative fuels, and so forth. The bad news is that we're not nearly far enough. We have halted the growth in energy use in Portland over the last 10 or 15 years, but we haven't started driving it down, and that's where we have to go. The other thing that I think lots of us have kind of a wondering about is whether the advantages Portland has may not attract more people to come here, which will just make our job of adapting more challenging. Our big recommendation, as you've already understood, is to reduce oil and gas consumption by 50% over the next 25 years. That's really based on a growing movement called the Oil Depletion Protocol that essentially indicates that if everybody did that, that's about what we need to do in order to match the rate at which these resources are being depleted. So I guess our feeling is it's not so much that we're planning to do something that we aren't going to do anyway, because we are going to do it anyway. Whether we do it in 25 years, we're not certain, but the question is whether we go there in a way that really defends our economy and our quality of life and maybe even improves our economy and quality of life, or whether we have it handed to us and all we do is react and actually degrade our economy and our quality of life.
Bill, I wonder if I can interject. Sure. Just, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but on this point I've already been asked by some in the media about how realistic this is. And my response has been, and I'm sure yours would be the same, is that you're not arguing to reduce energy consumption by 50%. You're arguing to reduce petroleum-based product energy consumption by 50%. In other words, we can replace a lot of that with biofuels, solar energy, wind energy. So I don't want people to misunderstand this goal, because I think this is a very achievable goal, especially if you think in terms of replacing the energy that is being used with other renewable energy.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think that we certainly agree with that we need to, and we applaud the initiative the city has taken to increase, and that the governor is taking to increase the development of those fuel sources and the market for those fuel sources and the production stream for those fuel sources, because one day that's what we're going to have, and that's what we're going to need to live on over the long, long, long term. And I think, but I think the task force would also want me to remind us all that the scale of that substitution isn't great enough to allow us to keep doing everything the way we've been doing it, but just with a different source of fuel, that we need to work on the demand side very hard as well as on the supply side. And there are lots of ways to do that without really hurting ourselves, but they aren't going to be easy. I guess maybe one other particular point I'd make here is that Europe and Japan already use roughly half the energy per capita that we do in the United States. So those who say that we inevitably will wreck our economy or our quality of life by cutting what we're doing in half, I think just are missing something, because this isn't rocket science. This isn't something that hasn't been done or can't be done. It's just something that we in the United States need to kind of get with it and get more aggressive about our efforts to preserve our economy and quality of life without using so much of the precious resource that's been provided for us. In terms of our other recommendations, they all really are fleshing out that one. But I think our second and third recommendations really are, we need to engage our citizens across the board in the effort and give them the information they need to make the changes that they'll have to make. And I think they'll have lots of incentive to make the changes because of price. We already see that happening now. The third recommendation is to engage the leadership in the community so that we are not just kind of having the city government doing something or the city government encouraging all citizens to do something, but that we organize and we get the organizations, the business organizations, the civic organizations, neighborhood organizations to actually each have a strategy and goals for achieving their part of what the community is going to have to do overall. We envision potentially competitions. There are lots of things that the city could do to help organizations get a plan in place and get moving. Moving on to kind of the substantive actions that need to be taken, these are pretty well known. I think in first place is the issues of land use and transportation, where about 40% of the oil that's used, or of the oil and natural gas, the total energy consumption is for transportation, and most of the transportation is fuel is based on crude oil, and we need to find essentially build a city that doesn't require as many trips and adapt our city in a way so that we don't need to take as many trips as we're taking today in order to live our lives and run our businesses. We also need to run those trips with a different form of energy and with much more energy-efficient vehicles. So we both need to reduce trips and have more energy-efficient trips. And the key to reducing trips is land use patterns and developing different kinds of the city. Then we focus on, that is, if we're going to ask people to switch modes, we need to provide modes for them to switch to. So I think you need to continue or accelerate your development of pedestrian, bicycle, and transit options so that the residents of the city have something else to do besides drive a single occupancy vehicle. And that certainly, by reducing those kind of trips, we free up our roads more for the freight priorities that we all have. And I think that giving priority for the use of the fuel to the freight movements that benefit a great many people, you know, makes a lot of sense. Next, we want to encourage both efficient and renewable transportation choices. I alluded to that a minute ago. That means alternative fuels, and it means fuel-efficient vehicles, and both of those are very important. The other big consumer of oil and natural gas besides transportation is space heating, and so energy-efficient buildings, retrofitting old buildings with insulation, with electronic thermostat controls, something that turns your heat down when you're not there, all of those kind of things. And in both the transportation area and the space heating area, there's a tremendous amount of waste currently. And even though we've had lots of movement over the years to try to get more efficient, we could be dramatically more efficient than we are. And so that's what we're urging you to do. Next, I think everybody who's concerned about peak oil has eventually gotten focused on the special vulnerability of the food system, the fact that food production, that's in fertilizer and farm equipment, in processing of food and transportation of food products, is a very large portion of all the energy use, and it's a very energy intensive operation the way we have learned to do it in the era of cheap fossil fuels, and those things are going to have to change. And because of the critical nature of food, I think it needs to be called out specially. And in particular, I think the city of Portland needs to be an advocate for the preservation of farmland in proximity to the city, so that less transportation and processing are required in the production and delivery of our food. And also, accelerating the efforts you're already making to connect Portland consumers with the local food supply and local food producers. Along the same lines, I think it's in order for Portland to really be a winner and not just a not too bad loser out of this system, I think that getting on board with the sustainable economic development movement that is rapidly getting traction in this state is really important, and seeking out the people that are both adapting their business models to more sustainable ways and the businesses that are engaged in helping others, consumers and businesses, do that. I think finding out what those businesses need and removing barriers to their success is critical. Finally, I turn to, I guess I'd say, the two areas where, instead of saying you need to do more and better, we're really saying we need a different scale of attention completely than what we've had to date. One is the social safety net that we're very concerned about, and I think whatever you can do to convene the helping agencies and your partner governments that have the primary responsibility for helping our impoverished citizens and our other people who have limitations, and trying to understand how food shortages and shortages of gasoline and so on can affect the employment, livelihood, warmth, the ability, the housing, and so on of our least affluent citizens, I think should be a real priority, because we see them as being the potentially a much bigger portion of our population if we don't get out in front of how we can meet their needs. Finally, the emergency planning of this community and others has not in recent years had a lot of focus on the potential for shortages of fossil fuels, and we think that's critically important for you to do, because between the long-term trend of increasing prices and less availability and all the geopolitical reasons why that could be a short-term emergency or a medium-term emergency as well as a long emergency, I think is something that we really need to focus on. What would we do if there were a significant cutoff in the availability of fuel? So those are our recommendations. Just characterizing for a minute, I would say we don't advocate that you create a separate peak oil initiative, because a lot of the stuff, as I've already said, that we're recommending is stuff you're already doing. We want you to do more and faster. But you're already doing it partly for energy efficiency reasons, but partly for clean air, global warming, quality of life reasons. And I think there are many social and community and environmental benefits of following the recommendations that we're making. So we would certainly encourage you to look at how you can meld your peak oil imperative with the initiatives in affordable housing, alternative fuels, and sustainability generally, efficient transportation and more efficient land uses that you're already doing. but still use the peak oil fact as a strong argument for intensifying those efforts. Finally, I guess we're very encouraged that you have all signed on to the resolution. We think the first step is really to adopt the goal to commit the community, and I think you can begin in the coming weeks and in the next budget year to make sure that you have the resources and time set aside to build specific strategies, to document kind of the baseline so that you can measure for the community how much progress we're making toward the goal of a 50% decrease, mobilizing city agencies not just around their own fuel consumption, but those of their constituents that they're serving, and beginning to engage the leaders of the community and the citizens in a larger effort. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So that completes the.
Yes, and there may be other members of the task force that would like to say a word or two to highlight whatever I left out or didn't get quite right. So anybody want to say a word? Randy, come on up.
Mayor Potter and commissioners, first, I really commend you for having me. Oh, I'm Marcus Samantle, and I chaired the subcommittee or subgroup on food and agriculture for the task force. Again, I commend you for looking at this and having an interest in it. As I became more and more involved with it, this is a major, major issue for this globe, not just for Portland. And Portlanders ought to be proud. Area that Bill did not stress, or maybe I miss it, is lengthening the necessity to lengthen out the transition period from when we go as a world from petroleum fossil-based fuels to whatever the next one is. And if we have 5 or 6 or 7 decades to do that by using good conservation methodology, that's a lot better than having 3 or 4 decades. I think we can handle the impacts if we can stretch that transition period out. And I would urge you to work hard to get all of these recommendations underway. Thank you so very much.
My name is Randy White, Mayor Potter, commissioners. Thank you very much again for giving us the opportunity to even contribute as task force members. And I'd like to bring up an experiment that was already performed to see how to speak to the business community about this, because one of the challenges in trying to explain to them that the growth of the economy as set up, how can you grow your business when we're asking you and your customers to conserve, is a real challenge for them to understand. And thus far, the business community is confused about this. So in the communications of how to make this transition, I feel it's going to be of great importance to look at the consumer behavior aspects of this and what the city can do to help businesses make the transition, and just strongly encourage you to get that message out to them as quickly as possible, because you are limited in what can be done, and really a lot of purchasing power, a lot of decisions that people are making on their own as an individual or as a family are going to be of utmost importance in how this change takes place and how fast it takes place. So on the business communications, the community communications part of it, I would encourage that part to get underway quickly, and appreciate everything that you're doing. And thank you again for giving us the opportunity to contribute.
Thank you.
Are there other task force members that want to address us?
Thank you, City Commissioners and Mayor Potter. I'm Angela Crowley Cook. I was a member of the Food and Agriculture Subcommittee of the Task Force. I'm also the executive director of the Oregon chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility. And at Physicians for Social Responsibility, we often use the phrase, prevention is better than cure. And I can't think of a more appropriate phrase for when discussing peak oil issues. If we don't take the appropriate preventative action now, as soon as possible, we'll be in for some very painful cures down the road. And like all task forces before us, we urge you to adopt and move forward on all of the recommendations. For example, if we work on achieving a 50% reduction in oil and natural gas use, but neglect to protect our farmland right outside of Portland, we'll be in for some very painful cures. And likewise, if we work on other recommendations but neglect reducing poverty and addressing unemployment, we'll also be in for some very painful cures. So I would urge the City Council to continue our great tradition of prevention in the City of Portland, starting with our 1993 adoption of global warming, a comprehensive plan to reduce global warming emissions. I hope that we will accept, and not only accept, but move forward on a comprehensive plan to address the impacts of peak oil. Because if the task force estimates of impacts of peak oil are accurate, this will be one of the most important things that we can do in this century. Thank you so much.
Good morning, Mayor Potter and commissioners. My name is Lisa Dixon Gray, and I chaired the Subcommittee for Public and Social Services. I just wanted to stress, talk a little bit about vulnerable marginalized populations. And when we were meeting, we had an awareness that the city doesn't really provide social services. The city doesn't provide public health services. And we sort of scratched our head a little bit, but we also had a realization that the city has a big interest in the economic well-being of their citizens. The city has a big interest in low unemployment rates. The city has an interest in ensuring that their citizens aren't impoverished. And because of that, we started looking at what kind of recommendations can we make to ensure that the city's interests are maintained. So we really did see we're very concerned about vulnerable, marginalized populations within the community that in a post-peak oil environment. So I just wanted to stress that, and thank you again for your attention to this.
Thank you.
So I guess before we go to any public testimony, does anybody have any questions of Bill Scott or?
I talked with your staff, and I just apparently there are some minor changes in Commissioner Adams' proposed amendment that your staff doesn't feel like is contrary to your.
Oh,
Mr. Mayor.
I guess I, you know,
Commissioner, this is the report that we're talking about. The resolution will come up on the next agenda item, so those
can
be addressed then.
Okay. Thank you for straightening me out on that.
Questions for Bill? Thank you, Bill.
Are you a task force member?
No, I'm not.
Oh,
okay. So just
I think
a
we have
second.
A
sign-up sheet.
How many people do we have signed up?
We have 10 people signed up. The first three are Jennifer Erickson, Scott Forrester, and Doug Benson. They'll be followed by Dan McFarling, Daniel Lurch, and Alan DeWitt.
Because of the number of people and the other issues we have to address at City Council, I'm going to ask you to keep your comments to 2 minutes. And when you begin, please state your name for the record.
Mayor Potter, commissioners, my name is Jennifer Erickson, and I am the 2007 chair of the Portland Multnomah Food Policy Council. And I'm here today to testify in support of the Peak Oil Task Force report on behalf of the FPC. The FPC was created in 2002 by the City Council and the Multnomah County Commission to advise city and county governments on issues related to food and the food system. The FPC is comprised of 18 citizens who represent a broad spectrum of expertise, including land use policy, health and nutrition, agriculture, and food access issues. We agree with the report's findings that higher energy costs are inevitable. The entire food system will be highly affected as current production relies heavily on fossil fuels. Farmers' equipment runs mainly on diesel, crops are trucked to processors, processing uses energy, processed foods are distributed via truck, and much of our food is either refrigerated or frozen. We concur with the report's conclusions that food prices will climb dramatically as fuel prices increase. Of primary concern is the impact this will have on our community members without adequate income. How will those living in poverty or near poverty afford higher food costs along with higher transportation costs? The FPC supports the action items listed in the task force's recommendation number 10 that address hunger relief, school breakfast and lunch programs, and program eligibility requirements. The Food Policy Council also wishes to draw your attention to recommendation number 4. It calls upon the city to designate and encourage neighborhood centers that put every resident within walking or easy biking distance of a full-service grocery store. A second major concern is the impact on farming and the food production system. We anticipate more demands on local agriculture to feed the metro area population. We must do everything we can to ensure that local agriculture will still be viable when that time arrives. Recommendation number 8 includes action items that complement some of the Food Policy Council's earlier proposals. The FPC reiterates their support for the efforts to reinstate the OSU Extension Service. The Portland-Multnomah Food Policy Council urges acceptance of the Peak Oil Task Force report and is ready to assist with work on the food system action items. We believe the time to move forward is now. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Scott Forrester, and I live in Gresham, but it's great what you folks are doing, and I applaud the report. However, I wanted to bring up something that it's a shame that Commissioner Leonard isn't here. Eric, you're here. That's good. We might have forgotten that at one point we were looking at taking over Portland General Electric. Now that it's supposedly a standalone PGE, we don't have to worry about it anymore. Well, that's not true. Part of the long-term success is having control over your future, and that means your energy future. And also the fact that because transportation will be connected to our energy future, such as hybrid electric vehicles, and coming off the line in 3 years, Toyota will have a plug-in hybrid so that you'll be able to increase your amount of electricity and ratio to your gas usage. And for most people in the Portland metro area, that means that the vast majority can go with 100% electric usage. That means your power company is going to be your connection to a sustainable, clean energy future. PGE just built its second natural gas power plant. It has a site for a third one. That's a 50 to 100 year investment. They're going to want a return on investment. That's not an investment in wind. Oh, they have a little bit, but that's a minor part of their portfolio. While they're buying or building natural gas plants, they're not buying from Bonneville Power, which is renewable. Now, we want to have non-salmon-killing renewable. That's also a challenge in the future. But the bottom line is, one of the biggest gains we can get off of peak oil is to also have this connection. I would advocate that Portland continues to look at acquiring both Pacific Power and PGE's territory within the city limits, and that we create a publicly owned electric utility which operates on a non-profit basis. That means that the most marginal citizens, instead of looking for handouts and energy assistance, can actually benefit in the form of lower electric rates, which we all will enjoy. And by the way, PGE still has the highest electric rates in the Northwest, and they never reduced them after Enron became no longer the parent of the corporation. So with that, I appreciate your time, and those things that are lacking, I'd like to at least be considered in the future. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Doug Benson. I'm here as the representative, as the president of the board of the American Institute of Architects, Portland chapter. And I think essentially we just want to offer our unqualified support for both the report itself as well as the resolution that you're going to be looking at. And to reiterate a couple of things, it was noted earlier by Bill Scott that buildings use a substantial portion of that energy, and so as designers of buildings, it's our responsibility to participate in that reduction very, very heartily. And you know, I think you're all aware that we've already achieved quite a bit in the city of Portland along those lines. We're considered leaders as we travel outside the city. People are constantly looking at us as leaders. And in fact, the architectural community in Portland is exporting more than we import these days because of our expertise. So I think we can achieve, have achieved quite a bit and can achieve even more. So in addition to our support for this, we urge you to go back to the goals you're setting today on a yearly basis and really think about ramping them up, because I think technological advances, people's comfort level with the strategies that they need to impose to achieve them are going to only improve. The momentum is there, and I think you'll be able to realize even more as the years come and go following this adoption. Thank you.
Our next three are Dan McFarling, Daniel Lurch, and Alan DeWitt. They'll be followed by Carla Bankston, Richard Koenig, and Jim Howell.
Thanks for being here, folks. When you speak, please state your name for the record. You each have 2 minutes.
Mayor Potter, commissioners, my name is Dan McFarling. I am speaking on behalf of the Association of Oregon Rail and Transit Advocates, also known as AORTA, and we've been working for balanced transportation policies in Oregon since 1976. I would like to commend the City Council and Bill Scott and the task force for their attention to the issue of peak oil and the need to realize a healthy, viable, sustainable community and economy. If we do not pay heed, we cannot sustain a healthy economy. The Peak Oil Report includes recommendations that the City of Portland prevent overexpansion of transportation infrastructure that may not be good for investment with higher fuel prices, invest in infrastructure that meets access and mobility needs with less fuel, and cut oil and natural gas use in half over the next 25 years. These laudable recommendations would also be appropriate to address the very significant issue of global warming, which also needs to be addressed. I would, however, like to draw the Council's attention to the contradiction between the Peak Oil Report and the recommendations of the Columbia River Crossing staff. The CRC staff based its proposals and its evaluation criteria on the assumption that we will have a 40% increase in motor vehicles on the bridge and no improvement in market share for public transportation. CRC staff have offered a 20th century response, expansion of pavement and multiplication of traffic, while the Peak Oil Task Force and the 21st century cry for a different approach. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mayor Potter, commissioners. My name is Daniel Lurch. I'm the Municipal Program Manager with Post Carbon Institute. We're an international nonprofit based in Vancouver, BC. We work on the twin challenges of climate change and peak oil with local governments. Portland is not alone in thinking about peak oil and reducing its exposure to high and unstable oil prices. In just the last year, jurisdictions like Oakland, Bloomington, Indiana, Hamilton, Ontario, and even the Los Angeles region have commissioned reports, hosted conferences, and set up task forces of their own, all on the issue of peak oil. Portland, however, stands out among these efforts with the release of this report and its recommendations. And as someone who works on this as my job, more than any other local government response I've seen to date, this report is remarkable for its comprehensiveness, its sobriety, and its urgency. This report will serve as a much-needed model for local government response throughout the United States and beyond. The report and the actions you take to implement its recommendations are indeed urgent and very timely. Oops. As the report notes, the U.S. Department of Energy report that was released last year said it'll take a minimum of 10 years to make the infrastructure changes necessary to even begin to cope with the effects of peak oil. At the same time, research around global warming is coalescing around a similar timeline. James Hansen, the director of NASA's Goddard Institute, is now saying that we have only 10 years to be well on our way towards reducing greenhouse gas emissions if we have any hope of avoiding catastrophic climate change. Fortunately, the task is not insurmountable, and Portland, perhaps more than any other city in the United States, is already well on its way towards reducing its vulnerability to peak oil and climate change to manageable levels. Also, fortunately, just about everything you do to respond to peak oil and climate change will save the city and the community money in the long run. From a risk management sense, a city planning sense, an economic development sense, and a public finance sense, the report recommendations make sense. We have only 10 years to transition to a post-peak oil and climate-changed world, and this report is an extremely important and valuable step in this transition. Thank you.
Thank you, folks.
My name is Alan DeWitt. I'm a resident of Portland. I live in Northeast Portland. And I want to propose specific steps that we all can take towards dramatically reducing the use of fuels. The cleanest gallon of fuel that ever can be used is the one that isn't burned. And the answer for each of us who commute to work is found by just looking at the three empty seats in your car. I specifically want to urge drastic promotion of carpooling. When you think about it, people that carpool with a car full of four people will reduce your monthly fuel gas bill by 75%. It allows three of the four passengers to read, to relax, to prepare for work. And the beauty of the situation is that it doesn't take any legislation, it doesn't take negotiations, it doesn't take any bureaucracy. It just takes leadership from the top down. And so I would encourage the leadership, such as the council and the mayor, to encourage all city employees and the heads of corporations, be they Nike or Intel, or the smaller corporations, to walk the walk, to drive the drive, to find three other people that they want to ride to work with, be they coworkers or friends who happen to work very nearby their place of work, and simply get together and try to get three, four people in your car. I recently saw an article in the Oregonian pointing out the fact that in the next 10 years, there's going to be a large number of people coming to this area. I don't recall specifically whether the figure was a million, but it was.
Your time is up. You're going to have to conclude your statement.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to the council for your time. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Our next three are Carla Bankston, Richard Koenig, and Jim Howell.
Thanks for being here, folks. When you speak, please state your name for the record. You each have 2 minutes.
My name is Carla Bankston. Good morning. I'm with the Portland Peak Oil Group, and I'm a resident of Washington County, and I just wanted to speak today to thank you so much for taking the leadership in this, because other counties like Washington County need the models to start seeing that the transition can work, and Portland is the city that can do it, and I've got my fingers crossed and waiting for it to go. Thank you.
My name is Richard Koenig. I'm with the Committee for Appropriate Enforcement of Motor Vehicle Laws. I think I can do as well of compressing my 3 minutes into two as the rest of us. While the general public must educate themselves and adopt the mindset conducive to life after peak oil, those who plan the transition to a more sustainable way of life cannot ignore the valuable contributions of the government that have been instituted for our peace, safety, and happiness. Now, here's the key. Oregon's former DMV director, David P. Mumau, instituted a very far-reaching program which will facilitate society's progress to a decentralized, bioregionally oriented economy. His program was recently instituted by the adoption of an ODOT administrative rule. The number is on this handout, which I'm going to leave with City Council Clerk, which provides authority to accept fees from the general public, but only when they choose to title their vehicles. The upshot of this rule will be to shift the burden of highway maintenance back to the transportation industry, as those who exercise their option choose to invest in their home energy conservation projects rather than pay the $2,000 or so a year that they previously paid to comply with all of the provisions of the vehicle code. The trucking industry, ultimately, never does pay the true cost of transportation, but actually passes that cost on to the consumer of goods that are transported. As the transportation costs increase, consumers will have a financial incentive to use the savings available through the new rule to take care of their needs in their own communities. As communities move towards self-sustaining practices, the volume of goods that are imported will decline, the cost will go up, and the spiral effect will lead to that comfortable post-peak oil transition. It's a rare phenomenon in the affairs of government today for rules to be promulgated to the direct benefit of the general public with specific infringement on corporate license. Mr. Mumau's rule is the prime example of this phenomena, and it'll be remembered into the far distant future. I think we should all give Mr. Mumau an expression of our appreciation. Thanks, David.
Mayor Potter, members of the council, my name is Jim Howell. I reside at 3325 Northeast 45th Avenue in Portland. I read in the morning's paper today about the city striving to use less fuel. I wrote a letter to the editor this morning, and since it probably won't get published, I'd like to read it to you. If the city is striving to use less fuel, why are they about to approve further study of only one option for the Columbia River crossing that would attract 50,000 more auto commuters a day onto a 10 to 12 lane freeway bridge with massive new interchanges? The scenario used to justify this mammoth $6 billion project assumes that in 2030, most Clark County commuters will continue to drive and only a small fraction will use public transportation. The scenario also assumes that freight tonnage on trucks will continue to grow faster than on rail, despite the fact that trains are up to 10 times more energy efficient than trucks. These scenarios should be reevaluated in light of future public policies regarding energy independence and greenhouse gas emissions. Remember what happened in the Washington Public, I think it was in the early 80s, in the Washington Public Power Supply System, otherwise known as WHOOPS, when they decided to build several nuclear plants based on faulty scenarios of future power needs. The same sort of thing could happen here.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The last person to sign up is Jeremy O'Leary.
Thanks for being here. State your name when you speak, and you have 2 minutes.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Jeremy O'Leary. I'm one of the lead volunteers at Portland Peak Oil, and I wanted to touch on a couple of points, namely my concern about if we become a lot more energy efficient, then biofuels will start becoming a viable alternative. I saw a blurb in the news yesterday that the Department of Agriculture is estimating half of domestic corn production will go towards production of ethanol, which, I mean, if you just look at the issues with topsoil loss and what's going on with the aquifers underneath the Midwest, we could put ourselves in a pretty serious position. And the recent corn crisis in Mexico was pretty directly linked by NAFTA and the ethanol production. So, I mean, biofuels are wonderful. I think they're great. I thank the city, the council for endorsing the creation of the task force, for all the work you've done on it, biofuels are a tool that we definitely have in our quiver, but we need to use it appropriately. And I know this is not quite city policy, but addressing the issue of a use of industrial hemp, which would be a much better source of domestic oil production for biofuels than soy or anything else we're currently allowed to grow. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all who signed up.
Okay. This is the report. We need a motion to accept.
So moved.
Second.
Let's call the vote.
Leonard?
Well, I just have a lot of thoughts about this, but I don't want to take up a lot of time other than to say I really appreciate the work done on this. I appreciate Commissioner Dan Saltzman's continuing leadership on sustainable issues. I think part of what puts Portland and Oregon in a particularly advantageous position with respect to reducing our reliance on petroleum products is our geography. And by that I mean we don't have to only be a leader in reducing the reliance on petroleum. We can be a leader in creating an economic development initiative of selling products to other states and countries that we grow east of the Cascades. Canola, for an example, bring it up the Columbia River via the Port of Morrow, the Port of Umatilla, which we're actually working on right now, having it converted in Portland on the Willamette River into a sustainable, environmentally friendly energy that can be used to fuel vehicles in Portland and Oregon, and then also have an amount necessary to export to other states. In addition to that, it's been interesting to me that some of the discussions about biofuels has become more and more popular as the oil companies have shown their unending nerve in raising prices, that they have embarked on this kind of campaign to suggest basically that if you use biofuels, you're taking food out of the mouths of children in other countries. And we've heard it here at council. I certainly get emails that say that. And as you can imagine, that's false. And for instance, and was mentioned here by the last testifier, soybean production, which is used to create biodiesel, canola production used to create biodiesel, has the oil squeezed out of it, and what's left is a high-protein product that actually is used for feed for either cattle or for third-world countries that don't have enough protein in their diet. So the fact of the matter is that we can dramatically reduce the amount of petroleum products that are used, dramatically, without impacting, in fact, I would argue, increasing the quality of life for a number of people throughout the world. In Portland, for an example, we used a million gallons of petroleum diesel to power our various equipments in the past few years. We just by converting all the diesel fleet to at least 20% biodiesel, and then some of the fleet to B99, have cut the consumption of petroleum diesel in the city by a third. We haven't done any less work. We haven't traveled any less miles, but we have cut the use of petroleum products by a third. And I think that we can show by example that this doesn't necessarily have to be an initiative that causes people to have to do without. You just do things differently. I mean, you put in fluorescent lights instead of incandescent lights, has a huge impact on your electric bill. You take the bus rather than drive everywhere. It's more convenient, it's cheaper, and you get to talk to people. Buy a bike. They're cheap to buy. You can ride your bike around town. And when you trade in your car, don't buy a gasoline vehicle. Buy a hybrid or a diesel-powered vehicle. That dramatically reduces the amount of petroleum. And that's not changing how you do anything, but the method by which you do it. So this is really good work. I appreciate it, and am happy to support this and other initiatives like this. Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, I think as Commissioner Leonard just illustrated, the overarching goal here of reducing oil and natural gas consumption by 50% in the next 25 years is really, I think, the art of the possible. And it takes a city like Portland and citizens, many of who spoke here today, who really are committed to the way of life of what Portland represents to many, and that is trying to do things different, trying to avoid mistakes of other big cities, reducing our reliance on single-occupancy vehicles as a means from getting from point A to point B, exploring renewable energy. Commissioner Leonard's leading the effort on biofuels. We're also in the process of negotiating with a company to provide all of city government's electricity from wind energy that would be generated in eastern Oregon, backing out natural gas and hydrofuels as a source of energy, which will have a good impact not only on our bottom line, but also on our greenhouse gas emissions from the city as well. So I think that it's time to act, and this is a goal that we can strive for. And I think through consistent actions, continued emphasis on land use and planning, pushing renewables, promoting sustainable industries in our economy, and as the head of the American Institute for Architects said, you know, they're now exporting their services and designing green buildings, and that's a positive for our economy. So I think this is doable. It's not going to be without some sweat, and we will come back and monitor the implementation of this as we go forward. And I want to thank again the task force for their 6 months of hard work, and we don't expect you to diminish your advocacy one bit. Aye.
Stan.
Well, thanks to Commissioner Saltzman for heading this up on the council's behalf, and really thank you to all the volunteers. I actually remember pretty clearly, because I was in the middle of a pretty tiring, it was exciting, but tiring campaign last year, and I visited the Peak Oil group, I think as a third of event of a night, and I remember kind of walking in there going, oh my gosh. And I actually at that point had familiarized myself with Peak Oil arguments and thought, you know, this is right, this is happening. And but I was still a little tired, and I left the room very, very energized. I was shocked to find 100 people in a basement working on Peak Oil as they are doing every week. And so that really got me fired up to kind of not so much take this on as try and attach your thinking and your, I think, urgency to a set of thoughts, strategies, actions that I think all are pointed in the same direction in Portland. And the issue is really, can we get there with more urgency? And can we get there more aggressively? And I thought the Act Big, Act Now slogan you've got, I haven't been quiet today out of a lack of enthusiasm. It's because I think your report has it right, and I read it. And I think it's time to get to work and see if we can get to this next level. And I think we can. You probably, all of you in this room know, but it's worth repeating for the audience, that Portland, and I wish we weren't alone, but we're the only major city in this country to reduce greenhouse gas emissions since 1990 levels. And I think what that shows, that it's happened at the same time, and I certainly am always working on affordable housing, but where any look at our real estate values will show you that the city has become more attractive, more expensive, more desirable during the time period that we're reducing emissions. And I think it actually undercuts the entire argument that it's not financially feasible. It actually, I think, can become a good piece of business. And so trying to promote the industries and like the architectural expertise, the green building expertise, I think is a huge part of our future. And it's also a huge part of roping in people and inspiring people who are not part of this movement at this point to show that there actually is a business angle to this. I spent some time watching my friend Randy White work last week with some advertising executives to try and put this in place. And I also think that we need to work on literally an advertising campaign around this. I don't know exactly how to do it, how to pay for it, but I think the city ought to consider putting some money into actually doing advertising around this report and trying to get people to think about it and hear it in different ways, because I think that it can become an opportunity not just to do the right thing, but to lead an economic strategy to turn things around. And the only question before us is, you know, how unprepared are we going to be when the shortages start? It's not a matter of whether they're going to start. It's a matter of some amount of when, but there's no doubt that the world will not be ready in 30, 40 years, the world will not be ready at this point. So the question is, and I don't think it's going to be that long, can Portland get out ahead of these issues? And thanks to all of your leadership, it puts us in a position to help get us there. So I'm greatly indebted to you and energized to keep working on this. And you know, the global warming numbers are a small increase in overall emissions, a relatively large decrease in overall emissions since 1990, a relatively large decrease in individual emissions. So the reason the overall, of course, is not as huge is because we're growing in population. So I actually think the next step is to get us to a large overall decrease, and I think we can get there, and this is key to it. So again, thank you very much, and I look forward to working with every one of you. Aye.
Potter.
I want to thank Commissioner Saltzman for his leadership, the Peak Oil Task Force for your stick-to-itness, bringing the issue. I think this report is a clarion call to our community that the assumptions of yesterday are not going to be the realities of tomorrow, and that the faster we move to reduce our use of fossil fuels, the better off we will be, the better off our children will be. It does require, I think, the city to consider how it does its job as well. And as we develop our citywide strategic plan, I want this to be an integral part of how we begin to plan citywide in many different arenas. I want all of the bureaus of the city to really have a vested interest and role in doing what they can. I want to make sure our neighborhoods are walkable so that folks can walk around their neighborhood to the store, and that our bike lanes are expanded in this city, that our transportation options continue to increase for people. The fact is, in Portland,